Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Center for American Progress press call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Jocelyn Frey. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, and good morning. I'm Jocelyn Frey, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and I want to thank you for joining today's call. Just as a reminder, this call is being recorded, and by being on the call, you consent to being recorded. Today's call comes in the midst of the commemoration of the historic March on Washington and on Women's Equality Day, the day set aside to remember the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. Both of these milestones are evidence of our progress towards making the promise of equality a reality, but they also are a reminder of the struggle that it took to get there. And that struggle continues. Today, we see attacks on voting rights across the country and regressive policies that threaten to undo the very gains inspired by the events we celebrate. Women often are bearing the brunt of these attacks, whether it's damaging women's health by restricting reproductive rights in states like Texas and North Carolina and countless others, or failing to respond to the basic economic challenges that many women and their families are facing across the country. Today, we find this war on women is alive and well. And while it's been the subject of much discussion, it's been made far worse by the egregious attempts to restrict voting rights and disenfranchise those voters who have the most at stake in many of the current policy debates. Women are disproportionately affected by some of these attacks. So 50 years later, after the March on Washington, and after that march created the political will to pass the Voting Rights Act, we need that same energy today to save and strengthen voting rights and protect against rolling back women's progress. And on today's call, you'll hear from Joy Lieberman, who has been personally impacted by voter suppression tactics. And you'll also hear from health, economic, and legal experts about the vital role that protecting voting rights plays in the work of advancing women's social, political, and economic equality. If you have any questions after this call, please feel free to contact Madeline Meth at 202-741-6277 or mmeth@americanprogress.org. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Joy Lieberman.
Good morning. Martin Luther King said, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." The right to vote is something I will never be silent about. The first time I went to vote was November of 1936. I was a tiny five-year-old clutching my mother's hand as she voted. My parents were the first in each of their families to be born in the United States, and they were so proud to be American. They impressed upon me how important it was to vote and vote wisely. I took their advice to heart, and since I registered to vote in 1952, I have voted in every single election, no matter how seemingly unimportant. However, when the time comes in a few years to renew my driver's license, I could be immediately relegated to the rank of second-class citizenship. I would have difficulty under the requirements of Missouri's proposed photo ID bill proving that I am really me. When I was in my mid-40s, I discovered that my original birth certificate did not include my middle name, which is the name I use and have always used. I had my birth certificate amended at my expense, but the amended version does not look very original or very official. Would some bureaucrat accept this as an original birth certificate? I honestly doubt it. I served as a local elected official for 24 years and ran 8 successful election campaigns. No one questioned my identity. I served on a state commission appointed by the governor for 5 years. No one questioned my identity. I was inducted into the Order of Distinguished Older Missourians at a ceremony and lunch at the governor's mansion. I was not asked to show an ID. I've lobbied my senators and representatives in Washington. Again, no ID. I've testified numerous times before the Missouri House and Senate, At no time was I asked to show a government-issued ID. Oh, I've been told not to worry, that I could continue to vote. I would just be voting a provisional ballot, which for me is the same as a non-vote, because with wisdom, age has brought me a hand tremor. In order for a provisional ballot to be counted, one has to be able to duplicate their signature. I cannot do this. You would be surprised at how many of us will end up in this predicament. How many seniors are able to duplicate their signature from many years ago? How many of us have birth certificates that don't include our current name? How many of us no longer drive or have expired driver's license that would not be allowed if these laws went into effect? In addition to disenfranchising me and more than a quarter of a million other Missouri registered voters and millions nationwide, it's unnecessary. In Missouri, we are currently required to show ID at the polls, and this works. The photo ID is expensive, and it's irresponsible during budget cuts to spend millions of dollars for an ineffective program or to find a solution to a non-existent problem. A long time ago, our government fought a war protesting taxation without representation. I wonder, if I'm denied the right to vote, will I then be exempt from taxation? I doubt it. I and millions of other voters throughout the country who will be disenfranchised are not provisional, marginal people. We are proud Americans who are entitled to vote and demand the right to vote. Driving, banking, renting a movie are privileges. Voting is a fundamental right in this country. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joy. I appreciate it. Next, we're going to move to Barbara Arnwine. Barbara is the president and executive director at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Barbara?
Hi, everyone. This is Barbara Arnwine. I want to thank Jocelyn and the Center for having today's conference call. It is very, very critical that we use this opportunity of the Women's Equality Day to talk about where women are in this fight for equality. And I am so glad that this is also happening within the time frame of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. What I found fascinating on Saturday was to look at the lineup of speakers and to see women so prominently featured in 2013 versus 1963, when virtually no women, only one woman's voice was heard from the podium versus last Saturday when dozens of women's voices were heard. It is critical that we continue to uplift the issues of women's equality and its intersection with the fight for racial justice, the fight for economic justice, and the overall fight for social justice in our nation. The attack on women that has swept this country has been waged simultaneously with what I call the largest and ugliest voter suppression attack since the 1960s. And what we are seeing is a movement that began viciously in 2011 and gained steam in 2012 and continues to build in 2013 to suppress the right to vote for people of color, low-income citizens, students, the disabled, the elderly, and, of course, progressive women. What we have seen is everything from restrictions on early voting, restrictions on same-day registration, restrictions on student voting, restrictions on voter ID requirements, and restrictions on the ability of people to cast a ballot and to have it counted. What has happened most dramatically this year, in the 50th anniversary year of so many advances in the racial justice movement, what we have seen instead is a retrogressive effect generated by the Supreme Court's decision on June 25th in the Shelby versus Holder case. The Shelby County case is a infamous decision that basically gutted the protections that existed under Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. It basically held that Section 4 was no longer constitutional, announced a new doctrine of equal sovereignty of the states, talked about current conditions having changed and pointed to increased African-American voter turnout, and said nothing whatsoever about the voter suppression that has been sweeping our country. Immediately after that decision was announced, that said that Section 4 no longer was law of the land, and therefore the 12,000 jurisdictions that were previously covered by Section 4 no longer had to comply with Section 5, which required preclearance by any jurisdiction that was covered by Section 4 of any voting change or any voting procedure. So now most jurisdictions no longer have to notify the federal government, no longer have to go to court or to the Department of Justice to preclear any voting change or practice to make sure it will not have a racially discriminatory effect. That same day that the decision was announced, several states that had been attempting to engage in voter suppression but were withheld by the power of Section 5 and 4 combined and started announcing that they would immediately impose and begin to implement their voter suppression laws. And that was Texas, where they have a voter ID law that basically threatens the right to vote for 800,000 citizens. North Carolina introduced a horrible bill to which we call the worst voter suppression measure in the country that does everything wrong on voter suppression. Mississippi and Alabama had put on hold their voter ID laws, and Alabama actually also has a proof of citizenship law. They put them on hold, and they announced that they would immediately begin to implement them. Florida, said that they would reverse, their decision and their position on early voting and start, imposing those restrictions on the counties that had previously been exempted under Section 5. Of the Voting Rights Act. This issue has a lot of impact on women. Women in particular are more likely to be low income. Women in particular are more likely to be really impacted by disabilities in their ability to be employed. Women are more likely to have changed their name and their name not match their ID. Women are more likely to have difficulty acquiring a birth certificate. Women suffer under these voter suppression measures as women because of child care who need the flexibility of early voting, numerous days to early vote. It's women who, because they have to pick up their children, need that flexibility of weekend voting, which has been cut out by many of the states. It's women who need early the ability to do same-day registration, because oftentimes that's their only opportunity to register to vote. Instead, what we are seeing now is a vicious attack on all of these rights by jurisdictions. One jurisdiction in Florida just last week announced that they would move their election board, which was the county's only opportunity for people to register to vote. They're going to move it from the center of the city out to a warehouse where there are no buses, no public transportation, no malls, no housing, nothing, and impose that kind of a difficulty on people to vote. Women have, you know, our connections between our, you know, our fights for WIC, our fights for, you know, the ability to feed children, our fights to have, you know, Medicaid coverage, our fights to have unemployment coverage, our fights to, you know, protect reproductive rights. Everything that we fight for is tied to our right to vote. And by trying to suppress our right to vote, everything that makes it possible for women to fight for equality in this society, to have a legislature that will listen to them, to have the ability to propose, you know, changes that mean are meaningful for the advancement of women, are affected by this horrid, ugly voter suppression fight that we're dealing with. So, in closing, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, the Leadership Conference, all the groups on this call, we're coming together. We understand that our fights are interconnected, that there's no such thing as a woman's fight that's separate from the fight for racial justice, because women of color are a manifest part of women's equality, and that we understand the same is true of voting rights. So it is so important for us to make sure that we are out there waging this battle. We have a toll-free hotline number that people can call to report any ugly voting changes, because that's going to be our biggest fight, is to know when these jurisdictions are doing bad things and being able to fight them either in the courts or fight them in their own chambers. And it's important that people call the hotline, and that's 1-866-OUR-VOTE, 1-866-687-8683, plus there's all other kinds of tools that we've created. But I'm going to stop there, and thank you again, Jocelyn. Thank you, everyone, for having me on the call.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Next, we're going to hear from Don Legans, Executive Vice President at Planned Parenthood. Don?
Yes, thank you, Jocelyn, and thank you to the center, and also to Joy and Barbara for your great remarks getting us started. I think all of us on this call know that there's a clear connection between strong voter protections and women's health. Women of all walks of life come to Planned Parenthood for preventive health care services. They are hardworking women, women who care for their families and community, and who are taking charge of their health. And we are so proud to be partners in ensuring women and their families can live lives full of opportunity. Yet, as we all know, sadly, many politicians have made proposing and passing restrictive legislation targeting women's health basically a full-time occupation, making it harder for women to make personal health care decisions with their doctors and families. And it is many of those same people who are inserting themselves between a woman and her doctor, who are now doing all they can to come between voters and the ballot box. And I think we can all agree that's not likely a coincidence. Over the last month, particularly in Texas, where we saw thousands of men and women flock to the state capitol to oppose an extreme legislative agenda against women's health care, as Barbara noted, 2 hours after the Supreme Court's Voting Rights Act decision, Texas lawmakers moved to implement a very strict voter ID law in an effort to limit the voice of Texans and, of course, one striking hardest at women and communities of color, which is so often the case and the intent. Fortunately, we do know that when we come together and show a unified, strong movement dedicated to justice, we're a powerful force. I was really inspired as I think about how do we move forward and go ahead as a progressive community in this effort by the Moral Mondays in North Carolina, where women and men in the state didn't just sit back and watch these limiting laws pass. Planned Parenthood and many groups joined with the state's community leaders at the state capitol every Monday, working to protect the rights of all people, and often going to jail for that again, and showing us a way that we can come together. Today, we celebrate Women's Equality Day, and on Wednesday, of course, commemorate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, honoring one of the pioneers of the civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He believed that voting should be easier, not harder, for every American, and he also stated, of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health care is the most shocking and inhumane. These movements go hand in hand, and we must draw strength from each other to keep moving forward. Clearly, this is going to require that we heed the words of Daisy Bates. I was reading all of the articles this past week where some of the great champions' words were brought again to life for us. And Daisy Bates, who was the head of the Arkansas NAACP for much of the 50s and 60s, and the one woman who spoke on that program 50 years ago, I now credit her with having invented leaning in, to borrow Sheryl Sandberg's term, when she said that we have to sit in, kneel in, and lie in if needed until the vote is secured for all. And I am here today to say that Planned Parenthood is all in. So thank you, Jocelyn. I'll turn the call back over to you.
Thank you so much, Dawn. Next, we're going to hear from Anne-Marie Benitez, who's the Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Anne-Marie?
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Dawson, and the Center, and for everybody who's on the call today. And for we are very honored to be part of this call commemorating today, which is such an important day, the day that women had the right to vote. Since then, so much change has taken place because women have had the opportunity to vote, and many issues have been able to be brought to the table. And as many of the speakers have already said, that women's issues go hand in hand with our ability and the right to actually raise and elevate those issues because of our ability to vote. One example of that it has been this whole movement and change that's happened with the implementation of healthcare reform. And Latinas are one group that definitely will be positively impacted with healthcare reform implementation. In fact, 1 in 3 Latinas are uninsured, and are more than any other racial or ethnic group to be uninsured. But we still face many, many barriers accessing healthcare, and many, many barriers when it comes to accessing our right to vote. With all the racism and conversations that are not only happening in regards to rights to vote, but also in the midst of this immigration debate. So Latinas have been challenged in terms of their immigration status, facing language barriers, discrimination, and much more keeps Latinas from accessing services, not only health care, but also our right to vote. And any policies that help improve those accesses is not only improves the lives in the community of Latinas, but for everyone. As many of you know, Latinas are in favor of protecting women's health. Studies show that Latinas are strongly in favor of access to contraception, and a strong majority of Latina voters agree that a woman has a right to make her own personal and private decisions about her full reproductive health spectrum without politicians interfering. And furthermore, across the nation, most Americans support including immigrant families in our health care program. 63% agree that aspiring citizens should be able to participate in Medicaid, and 59% believe people on the path to citizenship should be able to pay into and participate in the gains of healthcare reform. And these are Latinas who are speaking, these are voters who are speaking, and every time that we are denied our ability to vote, we are denied our ability to make our communities healthy and strong and represented. So today we are very honored to be part of this call and very honored to keep up with the fight and to make sure that every person continues to have the right to vote and to make sure that all of our voices are elevated, to make sure that we have good, strong, healthy families and communities. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Anne-Marie. And next we'll hear from Judy Lichtman, who's a senior advisor at the National Partnership for Women and Families. Judy?
Thanks so much, Jocelyn. Everyone at the center and certainly everyone on this call, it's an honor to be with you today in celebrating both Women's Equality Day and, of course, the 50th anniversary of the 1963 important march. Strong voter protections are critical for women. Arbitrary rules that make it harder for people to vote have enormous implications for women themselves. Increasingly, women play an important central role in the economic stability of our families. Women are the main co-breadwinners of our families and continue to be a majority of the primary caregivers in our families. In both roles, we have an impact on the overall economic security of ourselves, our communities, and the nation. I think you all know probably that too often pregnant women are forced out of their jobs or denied reasonable accommodations that would help them continue to work. Too often, women are denied pay and promotions that are offered to their male counterparts. Too often, workplaces fail to offer the kind of paid sick days and paid family leave that they need to support themselves, their families, their communities, and the businesses themselves. It's simply not sustainable to force workers to choose between the jobs they need and the families they love. Having a say in who the lawmakers are who will consider all the kinds of policies and laws that get passed in their communities has a direct impact on the ability of women to provide for their families and keep those families economically stable. Communities across the country are considering laws that provide paid family leave or paid sick days, and many states have been considering measures to promote equal pay and fair pay practices. These laws can make a difference for families struggling to make ends meet. Women have to be able to weigh in and have their voices heard and lean in the types of decisions that lawmakers make to affect their families and to ensure the kind of economic security that their families need. And full voter protections are needed to preserve those basic rights. I'm going to end with a friendly change, I hope, to the words of Hillary Clinton in Beijing in the 1990s when she said women's rights are human rights and human rights are women's rights. And for today, I want to make absolutely clear women's rights are human and civil rights, and civil and human rights are women's rights. I thank you.
Thank you so much, Judy, and thank you to all of our participants in today's call. I'm now going to turn the call over to the operator to open up the call for questions.
Absolutely, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using your speakerphone today, please release your mute function to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 at this time. And again, that is star 1 to ask a question. First, we'll hear from Karen Rubin with News and Photo Features.
Yes, thank you so much. You know, I'm just today writing a column on voting rights, and I thank you so much for providing this material for it. But what I'm looking at is gerrymandering. I'm looking at the results. And so what I'm not hearing from your call is we're acknowledging what's happening, and we talk about Moral Mondays, we talk about protesting, we talk about all of it, but it's more desperate than that, because what you have now is more votes being cast for progressive candidates, and still we wind up with these other individuals being controlling the government. How do you address that problem?
Well, I can start. I don't know, Barbara or Wade, if you want to speak to that, but I'm happy to respond.
Well, Jocelyn, this is Wade Henderson. I'm happy to at least join in. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, which is the nation's leading civil and human rights coalition with more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. The reporter asked, I think, a very important question, and that is, we are living with the results of gerrymandered districts that, of course, have reduced the effect of progressive votes in districts that have been carved in such a way that they concentrate voters from one party or the other in districts that become difficult to challenge. That has made a huge impact on our ability to, particularly at the state level, have our voices heard in meaningful ways. I think civil rights organizations like the Lawyers Committee, the Leadership Conference, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, the Legal Defense Fund, and others are deeply concerned about the effects of these gerrymandered districts, but they can't be effectively changed until the census data from 2020 and the new redistricting that takes place as a result of that. In the interim, we've got to make sure that we've registered every single voter who is eligible to participate and that we are able to mobilize voters to come to the polls regardless of who is at the top of the ticket. Of course, when a popular and charismatic individual like President Obama, or for that matter, Hillary Clinton, or in other communities, Mitt Romney and George Bush, when they're at the top of the ticket, they attract certain voters regardless of their otherwise established interests. Our job is to make sure that these midterm elections, like the 2014 election, as well as the presidential election in 2016, attract voters who share our point of view so that they can make their voices heard. We have an obligation to make sure that we've provided every protection available to ensure that those votes can be cast and counted. Thanks, Jocelyn.
Absolutely. Thank you, Wade. And, you know, I'll add to that that one of the purposes of today's call is to really talk about the connection between voting rights and women's rights and so many of the rights that many in our nation hold dear. And I think to build on Wade's point, you know, one of the way that you get more people out to vote is to talk about why these issues, why they have a stake in these issues, and that voting rights are not in a vacuum, but they're very much and inextricably connected to many of the rights that women hold dear, and they're connected to women's progress. And we will continue to make that case and make that point that, you know, many of these rights go hand in hand, and anybody who has an interest in them ought to be out there raising their voices about the voter suppression tactics that are happening across the country.
And Jocelyn, this is Barbara. If I may, I'm glad the caller raised this issue. That's why, you know, in part we're so supportive of the action that the Justice Department has taken to bail in Texas because of its, you know, retrogressive actions around the redistricting in that state, the congressional redistricting. But I also want to point out that even though we have this blockage at the congressional level somewhat, it is very, very important for people to vote in state elections, because there are statewide offices for governor, for lieutenant governor, for secretary of state, all of these elected statewide offices that through a gerrymandering has no impact is key. And it's very important that people are registered to vote and that they do vote, that they not, you know, sit back and say, well, you know, my vote doesn't count. It counts a lot. And besides, of course, as Wade pointed out, the you know, the upcoming census that will be done in 2020, I just want to remind people that there will be interim data available mid mid-decade that also could be used by legislatures and others to redistrict. So it is not you know, it's very, very incumbent upon us to never think that we should not exercise our rights. So I just wanted to say that. And I doubt that I'll be able to answer any more questions. I'm going to try to listen in for the rest of this, but I wanted to thank everybody for letting me participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Any other questions?
There are no other questions at this time, so I would like to turn the conference back over to Mr. Henderson for any additional or concluding remarks.
Well, thank you very much. And again, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Wade Henderson, president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. First, I want to thank Jocelyn Frye and the Center for American Progress and for all of the leaders who joined in this call this morning. The Leadership Conference, as a coalition of national organizations working on civil and human rights issues, is especially pleased and proud to co-sponsor this effort with Jocelyn and the Center, and to really lift up the significance of both the anniversary commemorating Women's Empowerment Day, but also the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. You know, the struggle for women's equality and civil rights are inextricably intertwined. The March on Washington was really the single most important demonstration of the 20th century, leading to the passage of civil rights legislation that helped shape the 21st century democracy, and that, of course, is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And although women are among the classes protected by the Civil Rights Act, history reminds us that women were included only as a poison pill to the 1964 Act, as some hoped to make the legislation so radical that it would fail. But women would go on to play a pivotal role in securing the bill's passage, just as they did in planning the 1963 March. Now, 50 years later, women are once again at the forefront of advancing civil and human rights agenda. Congress is positioned to act on key legislation that would restore the Voting Rights Act for millions of women, provide a path to citizenship for millions of immigrant women, and stop employment discrimination against women who are LGBT. And as the late Dr. Dorothy Height, the former chair of the Leadership Conference and one of the founding mothers of the civil and human rights movement, noted, ratifying the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women remains among the unfinished business of the civil and human rights movement. Now, the convention, known as CEDAW, has been languishing in the Senate for far too long. And ratification of this landmark treaty would affirm principles of fundamental human rights and equality for women around the world and provide an opportunity for national dialogue on how to address persistent gaps in women's full equality, particularly regarding closing the pay gap, reducing domestic violence, and stopping human trafficking. So 50 years after the March on Washington, almost 100 years after women received the right to vote, we recognize, of course, the tremendous progress that our country has made, but on issues of fundamental equality for women, we still have not made anywhere near the progress that we would have thought. And because of that, restoring the right to vote is central to everything else. So we look at the ratification of CEDAW by the Senate. We look at restoring the Voting Rights Act. We look at recognizing the role that women play in our immigration laws. All of that is essential to be addressed, and it starts with restoring the right to vote. So, Jocelyn, thank you for allowing me to participate as, I think, the only man who was here as a resource. I feel especially honored to have joined this very distinguished call and to recognize the important role that all of you play as leaders in our nation.
Thank you.